Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It is 4 minutes after the hour, and it is Thursday, October the 5th. And happy Thursday to you. Hope your day is starting well. Hope you got a good night's sleep. I want to start this morning with a verse I've been looking at for a couple days now, Isaiah 55. In verse 6, it says, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near." You know, sometimes when there's tragedies in life, and there's certainly been one in our country this week, people are looking to God, and they're seeking the Lord, which is great. I want to say that if you are in that position and you're doing that this week, way to go. Keep seeking him. You will find him. He is near. It was interesting, on this day in 1947, President Harry S. Truman became the first president to address the nation via television. And did you know that Harry S. Truman owned a clothing store before he entered politics? So he probably looks good on TV, too. I'm guessing his campaign slogan for president was, "You're going to like the way I look in the White House? I guarantee it." Anyway, we have a great show this morning. We have Kim Cotola coming up in this hour. We have Dr. Ann Bradley up next. She's going to talk about what happens with prices when there is a natural disaster in the world, like when people are starting to charge $20 a case for some water. Is that price gouging? Is that fair? Is that supply and demand? How do we view that biblically? We're going to talk to her about that as well. And then we're going to talk to Kim Cotola. Dr. Peter Kapsner is going to be with us. Be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. So glad you are with us this morning. I have on our studio line Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. And I've been recently thinking about some of the tragedies that have gone on around the world. And when there are times of crisis, like a hurricane, can you just legitimately jack the price up of stuff? Is there an ethical problem with that? Can you do that? So I thought, well, let's talk to Ann about that. How do you know if prices are fair? Ann, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Bill. It's nice to be with you again.
Thank you so much.
This is such a pressing question.
I agree. It's supply and demand, isn't it?
It always is supply and demand. Nobody wants to hear that, but that's always the answer. And it's funny that you ask this because, well, not funny, but it's just, I think, very relevant because it's been in the news and we've been talking about it a lot in my classroom, because students, I think, and people in general have real questions about this. When you go to the example that I use is when you normally go to get gas in your car at a gas station, the gas stations that have the little kind of convenience stores attached to them, you'll often see pallets of water stacked up outside, not under lock and key. You don't have to walk through the front doors. They're just sitting there and they're, mm-hmm. A couple dollars. And they're probably even cheaper than, if you go to Walmart or your grocery store. But they're what's interesting about that is there's just so many. There's an abundance. And when there's an abundance, the price is low. And we like, as consumers, low prices. So the question is, when people need it the most, when there's a hurricane or a natural disaster and people are cut off from supply chains, when they don't have electricity, they don't have refrigeration, we want to get them these things as fast as possible. And so the problem is, when that doesn't happen, what do we do? And as you mentioned, supply and demand is the way that we ration when scarcity has increased. So we don't think that that's a good thing when scarcity goes up, but what we want to make sure doesn't happen is that we don't want to run out. And so that increase in the price helps people conserve in the meantime, while supplies can be beefed up, and that, that induces the increase in supply that we need. So, are high prices good? Do we like them? No. But I don't really think it's a question of fairness, because it's, you know, the scarcity shock has nothing to do with fairness. It has to do with a bad thing that's happened. And so the question that the economist tries to address is, how do you overcome that bad thing? And how do you get more water to people and more electricity and ice and things that people need? So that's the way we think about it. We want that supply to increase.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to do it is for, in the short term, prices to go up.
Okay, well, Ann, maybe you can share with our listeners just how prices work. Maybe you've started to cover this already, but it influences the choices of both the buyers and the sellers. I mean, no one has control,
right?
Correct?
That no one person has control. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the worst, you know, the scariest scenario of a small town that has a monopoly. And in economics, what that means is literally there's one person who sells something,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a service, you know, there's one accountant, or whether it's goods, you know, the water. And that we think is a very bad situation, because they have more latitude over charging a higher price. It's only when there's lots of people trying to supply you with accounting services or bottled water, whatever it may be, that that price goes down. And so, you know, what we want to think about is that even the monopolist can't charge whatever price they want, because people can just say, oh, I'm not going to hire an accountant.
Right.
It's easier to say I'm not going to hire an accountant than it is to say I'm not going to buy water, of course. And so, you know, it's never really the case that one person has absolute control. That being said, as you mentioned, prices are always a negotiation between buyers and sellers. Think about us as buyers. We want to pay the lowest price possible. We'd love to get everything for free.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't do that because, you know, sellers have no incentive to supply it for free. And on the flip side, sellers would like to charge as much as possible for a case of water.
Right.
You know, $100, $200, $300, right?
Right.
They'd love that price to be as high as possible. But it's the negotiation between buyers and sellers that gets you the price. And this is the reason that prices can change, because demands of consumers change over time and the supply of things change over time. Here's an interesting question. In light of all the hurricanes that we've seen, you know, one thing I saw after Hurricane Harvey was the flat of water at the gas station was $20 versus, you know, probably $4 or $5 before. Why wasn't it $100?
Right.
Why not 1,000?
Yeah.
You know, that's the question. It's like, why, if it's possible for sellers to charge anything, why aren't they? And the real answer is because they can't. Because, you know, nobody's going to pay $1,000, but people will pay $20.
Mm-hmm.
People might even pay more than $20.
Mm-hmm.
So that competitive process is what we depend on to make sure people are taken care of.
Yeah,
and that's what we need, especially in these times.
Yeah. When is it price gouging, and when is it simply, I've got 10 cases of water left, and I can probably get $20 a case, and I'm a businessman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a good question. Price gouging just sounds terrible. I always tell my students, I don't want to be gouged by anything.
No.
Price or, you know, nothing. It's just not good. So I think that is in kind of inflammatory language that puts us all on edge, and I think rightfully so. The word gouge is bad. But price gouging, I think, is hard to understand when transactions are voluntary. So what I mean by that is, again, let's keep with this gas station analogy. You know, the $20, I have to still want to pay for that. You know, I have to walk in and forego my $20 bill. Now, I don't want to. I'd rather pay the $4. But the fact that I still, or some people still, will pay the $20 shows that they'd rather have the water than the $20 bill. And so that in the moment, that makes them better off, because $20 for water is better than no water at all. And it's certainly better than $50, right? And
mm-hmm.
so that's kind of the key to understanding all of this, is that I wouldn't call that price gouging. Here's what I would call price gouging. If you get kind of privileges from the government to block competitors for your market, so that you kind of create a little monopoly, which is what we see often in the regulatory regime of different states. This actually, I think, is price gouging, because in a normal market setting, if I had a lot of competition, I would have to drop my price to get business, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I can get the state to protect me from incoming competition, then it really allows me to charge much higher prices than the market would bear. I think that is where we think about price gouging, because we are forcing people, literally using the law in the legislative process to force people to pay higher prices.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's about coercion versus voluntary exchange.
Yeah. And let me take a little break. When I come back, I want to ask you about the biblical premises for prices. I'm speaking to Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute for Faith, Works, and Economics. Be back in just a minute.
Hi, I'm Ted Ross with the Faith in Life Minute. If you and your family are running from one activity to the next, listen to this encouragement from Dr. Linda Mental on how to slow down and get balance back into your life.
If you're just running from activity to activity and you just feel like you're the taxi cab mom or dad who's just constantly on the run and it's too much, then a lot of times I'll say to families, just cut something out. Just decide you're not going to do it. Learn to say no and bring back the family meal. If the schedule is so crazy that people can't even eat one meal together, you really need to rethink that, because the benefits of eating a meal together are absolutely astounding. If you did that, your kids would do better with nutrition, with academic performance. They have a lower risk for delinquent behavior. And that really seems to me like a really small price to pay for some really big results that can make things so much better in your family.
Find more healthy tips for your family from Dr. Linda Mental at myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back. I am talking to Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. We're talking a little bit about fair pricing and what happens when we're in a situation where there is a disaster of some kind and prices instantly go up. Is it price gouging? Is it just that's what business is? So, Ann, I want to ask you about the biblical premises for pricing. Are there biblical premises relating to prices?
Yes, there are. And I think that fundamentally this stems this is about property rights. So if I have a property right in something, then I can choose to sell it, to manipulate my property to make it into something else and then to sell it to you. And you have the same rights. And so we see this in the Ten Commandments. We see this in all through Scripture. But really, prices don't come about without property rights. This is really the problem with kind of communist systems and extreme socialism, is that when property rights are eliminated, there's no boundary between what's mine and what's yours, and that is unbiblical.
Mm-hmm.
And so prices emerge from property rights. And then, moreover, you see scriptural evidence as well for, being able to engage in exchange and being able and encouraged to buy and sell things. My theologian colleague, Art Lindsley, talks a lot about the fact that Jesus spent a lot of his life in commercial exchange. He was a carpenter. So he sold his services for a price. And most people don't think about that when they think about the life of Jesus. So, as a model for us, he was somebody who had skills and he sold those skills for a price. And, when we're talking about labor, we call that a wage.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can look to Scripture both for examples of exchange via prices, but also the scriptural evidence for respecting prices and respecting exchange based on people's property rights and their role as stewards. So I think there's a lot in Scripture that helps us understand this.
Mm-hmm. So, and when we try to figure out how to set pricing and how to set fair pricing, isn't it kind of almost a voluntary relationship between seller and buyer? Because you have to find a buyer that's going to pay for your good or service, and it has to be within reason that the greatest number of buyers will purchase, or you can find someone that'll pay for it.
Exactly. So the way I like to think about this is something like an iPad. The first iPad came out probably 9 or 10 years ago, something like this. And, this has had something that had never really existed before. So how does Apple even figure out how to price this? This is very hard. It's probably the hardest thing that entrepreneurs do, especially when you're talking about something that has never really existed in that form before. So, Steve Jobs and his friends at the time at Apple, they could have said, well, let's just sell this to our rich friends and charge $10,000 an iPad. And
yeah.
So then you have to be, Beyonce or somebody to be able to afford it.
Right.
And they could have done that, but because they're only going to sell a limited number, there's a natural inclination, even though they kind of have a monopoly, right? There's no other person that sells exactly that thing, and we've never really seen it before as a product, but still, you know, I think the original iPads were about $1,000. And if you look back at the news reports coming out at that time, they flew off the shelves at $1,000. Well, mm-hmm. we just bought an iPad a year ago, and I think we paid $200 for it. And yeah. it's much better than the first generation.
Oh, right.
So that's the process that we're talking about, right? And it only happens when, as you say, as a seller, I have to find a buyer. And I don't want to find one buyer. I want to find as many buyers as I can. And so that natural, you know, kind of inclination drives the price down mm-hmm. a bit. And that's a good thing for us as consumers.
Yeah. And then what about as Christians? Do we have a sense of gratitude for things like, well, I can complain that gas is $2.50 a gallon, but do I really want to go on the internet and research how to refine my own oil and start drilling for it?
Exactly. Yes, this is a great question, and I like to talk about this a lot because what economists understand about prices is that they're signals. They give us a lot of information that would be very hard for us to find otherwise. So let's go back to the water example. You know, the fact that the water goes from $4 for a case to $20 for a case, we know it's not good for us. But we don't have to understand the, you know, long supply chain of bottled water. We don't have to know where the water originally comes from or the manufacturing process or the distribution. We don't have to know anything. We just have to say, okay, it used to be four, now it's 20. Something's going on. But the most important signal it sends to us is that I need to slow down on this consumption mm-hmm. because I want to preserve it and cherish it because it's a little bit more scarce or a lot more scarce than it was yesterday. And so prices really economize on our need for information. So as you mentioned, you know, when gas goes up at the pump, I don't have to know anything about manufacturing crude oil and pulling it out of the ground and turning it into gasoline,
right?
Which would be hard for me to learn. It would take a lot of my time, right? But prices just give us a lot of compact information and allow us to be nimble.
Yeah.
So in the moment, I can say, okay, I got to change my consumption the best that I can.
I mean, let's face it, Ann, we're miserable without each other. I mean, for you to jump in your car and drive to the grocery store to get a gallon of milk for your family, there are a lot of people participated in that activity.
Many, many people.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of people that we'll never know. And,
right.
you know, I think we need to be grateful for this, that we can jump into the grocery store. And, there's places in the world right now where people cannot jump into the car and go to the grocery store for a variety of reasons, and they are very poor because of it.
Mm-hmm. And Your new book called Counting the Cost, Christian Perspectives on Capitalism. I know you're a contributor to that book, but thank you so much for your contribution. Where do we learn more about that?
At www.tifwe.org. You can also check it out on Amazon. So
okay.
We'll
put that up on the website because it's hard to follow what you just said.
Great.
Yeah, Ann Bradley.
Yeah, a lot of words, a lot of letters.
Thank you so much for taking the time today to be on the show. Always love having you as a guest.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Have a great day.
Have a great day. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
Starting your day with faith, hope, and clarity. The Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold on Faith Radio.
Good morning. Happy Thursday. It's October 5th. Starting off our day well. I hope you are too. We're going to have a little break for news, and we're going to talk to Kim Cattola from Cradle My Heart Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Good morning. It's 28 minutes until the top of the hour. If you're struggling with your circumstances today and possibly feeling depressed, listen to this word of hope from Pastor Rob Morgan.
We just can't stay down in a place of depression. And I've battled, most of us have at least battled low-grade depression, and it can just pull you under. And sometimes you just have to stand up on your feet and quote Scripture and say, "The joy of the Lord is my strength." It's not always found in the circumstances. It's not always found in the way that we may feel physically or what may be happening in our lives. But the joy of the Lord is our strength. And there is just something very powerful about that verse. And in this book, The Strength You Need, I tell the whole story of how Nehemiah and Ezra and the people of Jerusalem in that day began to experience that for themselves, and the exuberance that came over them as they decided they weren't going to mourn anymore. They were going to choose to be joyful, and that gave them strength.
If you want to hear that full interview from Pastor Rob Morgan, go to myfaithradio.com. You can check it out. Type in joy or choice or Pastor Rob Morgan. We'll take a break, and then when we come back, Kim Cotola is going to be with us. Be back in a minute.
So you've messed up. You don't have to go on living there. This is Jim Garlow. Let me encourage you. Don't grow weary of attacking those enemies of God that are still tucked away in your life. Even if you've had defeat after defeat after defeat, get right back up again. The Old Testament Israelites are a great reminder. God told them they couldn't live in the same land with pagans. Why? Because the pagans would eventually corrupt the children of Israel. Here's the principle. Sin, when tolerated, always wins. James 3:11 says, "Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring?" Are you experiencing spiritual defeat in your life? The next question you ask yourself is, what sin am I tolerating? What sin are you allowing to have its hold on you? Confess it. Get rid of it. Then watch the victories begin. This is Jim Garlow.
Back. You see, we weren't gone long, just a little bit. It is 25 minutes until the top of the hour, and it is still Thursday, October 5th. Welcome to the program this morning. We've got Kim Cotola on our studio line already from Cradle My Heart Radio. Kim, good morning.
Hey, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. So we've got a little bit of activity in the House. They're approving the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act.
Yes, and you know, so this bill in various iterations has been around for mm-hmm. quite a while. It was passed by the House in 2015. It's got to, of course, clear the Senate, but President Trump has publicly endorsed it earlier this week on Monday, I believe. He came out and said he will sign it if it gets to his desk. And so what we have here is protection against late-term abortion, something that has never been enshrined in federal law. People are often shocked, Bill, when they find out that the way the law reads right now, abortion is legal up to the ninth month until the day of the birth of the child,
mm-hmm.
meaning that a healthy baby born when that child could easily live outside his or her mother's womb. The government says we have no interest. This is what the law actually says. The government says we have no interest in the life of that child. The only interested parties are the pregnant woman and her physician. By the way, Bill, did you know, this is a side note, but I just have to mention this. So I did a lot of reading on the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act this week. And all of the outlets that are against this, that want women to have the right to take the lives of their children after 20 weeks, are now talking about pregnant people, not pregnant women.
Hmm. Say more.
To accommodate transgender men who are getting pregnant.
Oh, yeah, that part.
So I'll just leave that with you. I just thought that was a very interesting development.
Yeah.
You kept seeing pregnant people, pregnant people, pregnant.
Yeah.
Well, what kind of people actually get pregnant?
Let's just pretend away reality, can we?
Anyway. So, yes, so now the House voted and passed it, and they passed it by a pretty healthy margin. And so I'm encouraged by this. You know, there are horrible cases, Bill, where, you know, something will not be evident in a pregnancy until 20 weeks or later. And the child, you know, will either then be stillborn or there will be, you know, a fatal condition that is uncovered. But anecdotally, because nobody tracks this, Bill, there is no federal regulation of the providers who are doing these abortions on children who could live outside the womb. No governmental agency is practicing any oversight again, because the law says the government has no interest in the lives of these children. But anecdotally, those who are, you know, trying to gather the evidence have said probably 75% of the cases, these are healthy children.
Mm. Kim, it says that scientists have confirmed that children in the womb can feel pain at 20 weeks or earlier, and the pain they feel may be even more excruciating than pain experienced by adults because of the development of neurological mechanisms while in the womb.
Well, yeah, this bill has been nicknamed Micah's Law, and Michael Pickering was actually, his birth started at 20 weeks. His mother's water broke, and she was on bed rest for a couple of weeks. Then he was born at 22 weeks, and his team said, he's 6 years old now, by the way, and very healthy, and incredible advances are being made with these very young children born prematurely. Anyway, his medical team said they had to be extra careful because he was more sensitive to pain than the average premature, than the average child born early.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, children can feel pain. There really is not, it's a very difficult thing to prove, right? But there's a great deal of evidence and a great case that has been made that says these children can feel pain due to neurological developments and other evidence that the scientists have brought forward. Planned Parenthood tweeted out that it was junk science, was junk science.
I knew there had to be some opposition to the scientists.
This is what they do. Instead of entering into an honest disagreement and presenting their evidence, they're going to say that's junk science, the evidence that's been presented mm-hmm. in the scientific
by scientists.
Community.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and my point in this bill is to a degree, it may be unknowable. We can't get inside the womb and ask the child, right? So to a degree, we're all hypothesizing here. But on the chance that it could be true that these children experience excruciating pain, and that, excuse me, but the methodology for late-term abortions is dismemberment.
Mm-hmm.
That's cruel and unusual punishment.
On the
possibility that these children could experience that and as painful, shouldn't we err on the side of caution?
Mm-hmm. What kind of anesthesia, if any, do women have when they have abortions?
Oh, well, none. You know, and a lot of people who supported these measures early on were worried that that's what the abortion industry response would be. Well, we'll simply do an anesthesia and then do the dismemberment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when there's intrauterine surgeries, because Bill, medical advances there are stunning. These miracles where spina bifida or some other condition will cause surgeons to go in, operate on the child, and then, you know, close mom up and wait until, you know, the child is born several months later. When those procedures are happening, those children are given anesthesia for those intrauterine procedures. And that is the state of the art medically.
Wow.
So, yeah, to stand against the idea of fetal pain, I think, is really to be anti-science.
Mm-hmm. So when Planned Parenthood, what are some other talking points they have against this?
Well, you know, their main thing, Bill, is that they want women to be able to make their choices. Trust women mm-hmm. is, of course, their default. But if they're, you know, and they say it's for health reasons, so they'll take a look at, you know, what are some of the conditions. And by the way, it's often at that 20-week point that parents become aware that a child will have Down syndrome, mm-hmm. for example, which is not a life-threatening nor fatal condition to mother or baby, right? They wouldn't talk about that, of course, because, I mean, I think that would show them as being somewhat heartless.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll talk about, you know, they'll prey upon the sympathies of everyone who's not involved and talk about, you know, fetal anomalies and talk about, you know, difficulties where a child is not, is stillborn, but there may be some ambiguity. And so that woman, it's cruel to make that woman continue to appear pregnant and everyone's, you know, talking about her pregnancy when she knows it's not. It would be better if she could just go and terminate that pregnancy. Bill, these ethical gray areas are indeed heartbreaking,
mm-hmm.
but it's, to me personally, despicable that Planned Parenthood or any other organization would exploit those tragedies to try to set a policy that's then going to be able to exterminate healthy babies, because that's really what's happening.
And then doesn't Planned Parenthood, when they come to discussing late-term abortions, always talk about them as, you know, rare and done only for health reasons? Seems that whenever you pull out the word rare, that it's, for some reason you should get a pass.
Right. Well, you know, according to, and again, we have to extrapolate this because there is no government oversight. Okay. The government has decided it has no interest. And we need to ponder that, Bill. That's like saying that the government decides, we wake up tomorrow and the government decides it has no interest in the lives of newborns. Therefore, any parental behavior is acceptable because we as a society should trust women. Well, in that utopia, that's great. But here, back here in the real world, we know that sometimes parents are incompetent, negligent, abusive, or criminal toward their children. And of course, the government has an interest in protecting them as weak and vulnerable members of society.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But somehow, when this child, again, who could live outside the womb, is not yet born, the government has no interest. That's mm-hmm. the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The problem really isn't Planned Parenthood. The problem is that we as a culture have agreed that we have no interest, that we are not our children, brothers, keepers. I don't know how to best
yeah.
say that. You know, that we've washed our hands of it. And so I'm sorry, I forgot what your specific question was. But to me, this is the issue. That's the heart of the issue, is whether or not those of us on the sidelines decide that these children deserve protection
yeah.
under the law.
Kim, let me take a break. When we come back, I want to continue our conversation about some of the things going on in the pro-life news, and there's still much to cover. It's 15 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be back with Kim Cotola in just a minute. Welcome back. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Speaking to Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart Radio, we're talking about the legislation that is just passed the House, on its way to the Senate. Don't know what's going to happen there. But there is roughly an estimated 1.21 million abortions in the United States annually, and over 15,000 of those probably take place after 20 weeks. And, you know, Planned Parenthood will always say it's rare and everything, but hey, boy, they charge nearly $1,500 to end the life of a preborn child between 14 and 20 weeks. And then there's all this discussion that's been caught on undercover video by the Center for Medical Progress that's bargaining over prices of body parts. I still smell a rat.
Well, you're right, Bill, because, yes, and that was what you asked me about the rarity of it.
Yes.
If we look at 20 weeks, there are probably, by some estimates, 35,000 abortions of children 20 weeks or older in the U.S. every year. That's a pretty stunning figure. And yes, it is rare when you stack it up against a million. Each one of those child those lives matters.
Mm-hmm.
But the 35,000 are the profit margin for Planned Parenthood, because as you said, if they those are the specimens that are most desirable for medical research. And Planned Parenthood, you know, has objected that they are not profiting, but it's been demonstrated by the Center for Medical Progress and by earlier investigations that indeed they are. And that these are, you know, that if they can provide specimens, they benefit. And so doing later term abortions is something that, I think it's about 1,500, according to some sources, for a 24-week procedure versus 300 or 400 for a first trimester abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there are all kinds of other economic and ideological pressures that enter into this discussion. And the part of the thing, Bill, is if we admit that children feel pain at 20 weeks gestation, then we're saying that they're human at
mm-hmm.
that point. You know, and this was one of the rationales for the Supreme Court back in 1973, saying that it was acceptable to end the life of children in utero because they're not fully human. They're not fully human, which is, again, anti-science. Mm-hmm. Embryology says that they are human, a distinct, living, and whole human being, the zygote. As soon as fertilization takes place, it's a brand new organism. And think of it, Bill, at the moment you became a zygote, like your eyebrows were already mapped out.
Wow.
Your fingernails were already, right? Because, the, you know, your basic fingernail hasn't changed since the day you were born. Well, it was there when you were a zygote.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that we attain to humanity in degrees is wrong. We develop as humans, but we remain the same human from conception forward. So this, the Supreme Court got that wrong in the science. And now for the abortion industry to have to admit that any child before his or her birth is fully human means that their whole game comes to an end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was at my best back then, Kim. My ultrasound picture is the last good picture I took. They never seem to get the right side after that, anyway. But I mean, even this discussion is for me, it's pure horror, absolute pure horror to hear that this is being done, and these kids at 20 week are feeling pain and
Well, as you know, by allowing abortion after 20 weeks, we're one of only 7 countries in the world. So, and that puts us in the company of China and North Korea, Bill. It is barbaric. It is inhumane.
Mm-hmm.
It is unconscionable that we are allowing this in our country. And we're doing it under the cover of compassion toward women.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And even the strongest supporters of legal abortion in the first trimester are appalled at abortion after 20 weeks. This is a very common sense measure that the House passed this week, and we really need to keep it in our prayers that this would actually become law, because mm-hmm. you know, some people have said, well, this is just a tactic to get abortion criminalized once more. Well, it is a tactic to protect all children before their birth. I'm willing to own up to that.
Yeah.
And again, those who are intellectually honest have to say, you know what, if I'm wrong and children can experience pain, then maybe I'm wrong about their full humanity throughout the course of their young lives in utero. And, we don't want to crush anybody, Bill. The point is not to be right. The point is, okay, if you presented new evidence you didn't know before, take that in and let it settle into your heart and begin to care about the children as much as you care for their mothers. Of course we care for the women.
Right.
And the situations women are in are dire sometimes, but that's when we as the church, that's what we're here for, right?
Absolutely.
We're the answer.
Yeah, and you go, girl.
You have to step up and do it.
Yeah. All right. Kim, talk about the pro-life group that bought out a late-term abortion practice.
This was really cool because this happened. Leroy Carhart is one of these practitioners. There are 7 states, Bill, where you can get abortion up through the 9th month. And I think in the District of Columbia as well. And so a family moved into Central Maryland and found out that he was practicing very nearby. And they said, nah, we can't live with this. So they decided that they were going to try to do something about it. And they got in touch with the local pro-life organizations that had been working for a long time to try to move Carhart, put him out of business, move him out of their neighborhood, but really put him out of business. And a move was made where he was able to be bought out. They raised money. And it turns out that Carhart and his organization were tired of the protests, publicity, legal fees. They were willing to sell. So for $1.2 million, they sold their 2 abortion businesses, one in Germantown and the other in Prince George's County in Maryland. And it's a 2-unit medical condo that was included on the deal. And so this churches and organizations budgeted money toward the vision. And over 3 months, Bill, they pledged the $600,000 that was needed to add to the money a Christian businessman pledged. And they bought him out. Some people have said he's going to just open up somewhere else, but right now his web presence says that the locations have both permanently closed. So that's a win, and to me, that is the church being the church. That is people in their local community saying we can do better for these women, not on my watch.
That's powerful, really powerful. And of course, we have a World Down Syndrome Awareness happening.
That's, yeah, the month of October.
I
was really encouraged by President Trump's statement. He said people of all ages with Down syndrome have inherent dignity and unique and special gifts. And, you know, he noted that, I mean, we've talked about this, Bill. In Iceland right now, 100% of babies diagnosed prenatally with Down are aborted. Here in the U.S., it's about 67%. In the Netherlands, they're actually going the other way and telling mothers they have a moral duty to abort.
Wow.
Because, you know, you're just consigning a child to a life of suffering, which is, of course, a stereotype that is so debunked and so outdated that, again, it's really anti-scientific to hold such a view. People with Down syndrome are getting degrees, they're marrying, they're having careers, they're having full lives. It's discrimination of the first order. Ableism is what the Down syndrome community calls it. That says because people are differently abled, they shouldn't have equal human rights.
Mm. Kim, what do we have coming up Sunday on Cradle My Heart?
Sunday, we're going to hear a story of a woman who has overcome so much, Bill. It's a really tragic story of a woman who chose abortion for her boyfriend, and 1 week later he left, and she was never able to conceive again. But the victory that she has found through faith in Jesus Christ has overcome all of that so that she shines in a really unique way that I hope everybody will get a chance to hear.
If you ever want to interview another woman who had to overcome a lot, interview my mother because she had to raise me.
Private message me her number.
I will. Thanks, okay, Kim. Well, have a great day. 3 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll be back in just a minute with more of the Early Morning Late Show. That wraps up hour one. Thank you to Kim Cotola and Dr. Ann Bradley. We've got a great second hour coming up. Dr. Peter Kapsner is going to be in studio. Look forward to that. And then a little bit later on, my dear friend, Dr. Mark Wickstrom, pastor from Las Vegas. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.